Inside Florida Politics. The Essential Podcast powered by Gatehouse Florida. I'm Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett coming to you from the heart of the 561 in West Palm Beach, Florida. And I'm joined as always from Tallahassee by the Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief John Kennedy.
Hi, George.
And normally we're joined by a third podcaster, Zach Anderson of the Sarasota Herald Tribune. But Zach is on assignment this week, so it's just me and John. But you know, even at a two-thirds personnel level, I think John would agree, we are prepared to meet or exceed all podcasting standards in all 67 Florida counties. So I'm going to let her rip. You know, President Donald Trump was in Florida again this week, about as far away from Mar-a-Lago as you can get and still be in the Sunshine State. He was up in the deep red and deeply hurricane-ravaged panhandle region of Florida. We will discuss what the president had to say there about Hurricane Michael relief. And he offered some thoughts on some members of the Democratic presidential field for 2020. Also, the 2019 Florida legislative session is over. That means the veto and court challenge season now begins. And John Kennedy will fill us in on what's going on with some key legislation and the prospects for what'll stay and what'll go in Florida's $91 billion budget and a few other topics from Tallahassee. But first, I believe I'm hearing some kind of royalty-free funky music playing. Listeners of the podcast know when you hear that music, it means it's time for our Pick a Number segment. That's where each of us puts forward a number. And then later on in the podcast, we explain what that number means in Florida politics. Just the two of us here today. John, why don't you go first? What number do you have for us?
Yeah, George, I'm coming in with an 11 this week.
Ooh, a Spinal Tap influenced 11 for John Kennedy. I believe that's XI if for our Latin listeners, if we're doing that, it's in Roman numerals. So John Kennedy with 11. And my number is going to be 500, which I believe, what's that Roman numeral for that? I think that's a D. I'm going to go with D or 500. And if it's not D, we'll edit that out of the podcast later. So if you're keeping track at home, it's very simple this week. John Kennedy with a number 11. And George Bennett, that's me, with a number 500. Those are your numbers. You want to remember those and find out at the end of the podcast what they mean in Florida politics. But let's turn to our loaded lineup. As I mentioned, President Donald Trump was in Panama City on Wednesday night. It is a reliably Republican part of a key swing state, Florida. And it's a part of the state that's still reeling from Hurricane Michael last October. And before the president came to the panhandle, even his strongest allies were saying he should not come empty handed. Here's a couple clips. Let's start out. Here's a clip of President Trump addressing the Hurricane Michael issue early in his remarks Wednesday night.
You got hit with a little hurricane called Michael. That was not a nice hurricane, I can tell you that, but it's going well. And I'm thrilled to be here with really, truly incredible men and women of the Florida Panhandle.
All right. So always acknowledge your audience and that they were hit with a little hurricane called Michael. And but then not long after that, he got to kind of what everybody is waiting for, to see what kind of dollars he was going to promise. If we can cue that.
And
next
tonight,
one
I'm pleased to announce that my administration will be allocating $448 million in HUD disaster recovery funds for the great people of Florida. And these dollars will help communities get back on their feet. We've already given you many, many millions of dollars, but these are additional monies that are coming in to help the families put their lives together. Some families are still working very hard. It's been a tough one, More money is needed. I've just come from a stop at Tyndall Air Force Base where I saw the devastating effects of that Category 5 hurricane. Category 5. Never heard about Category 5s before. Category 5 is big stuff.
All right. Category 5 is big stuff indeed. John Kennedy, but before the president got to the panhandle, Florida Democrats had one of those pre-buttal conference calls to talk about the president's visit. Give us a rundown on what the Democrats were saying in advance of the president's arrival.
Yeah, no surprise. You know, they dismissed it pretty much totally. They ridiculed his visit in advance with Congressman Debbie Wasserman Schultz. She was saying that it amounted to, her quote was, fancy words and a lot of fluff for people in the panhandle. And much of the criticism was aimed at the administration for not pushing the Republican-led Senate to act on a multi-billion-dollar relief package that did clear the Democratic-controlled House, but it ran afoul of the administration because it poured more aid into Puerto Rico, which, as we know, is still recovering from 2017's Hurricane Maria. So, you know, Trump shows up with the money for the panhandle, a little bit extra, $448 million. Housing is a huge problem in the region right now, particularly in Panama City and Bay County. The legislature's roughly $220 million package of aid that it just recently approved in the budget, that brings overall state spending to $1.8 billion on storm relief and recovery. Much of that is reimbursable from the federal government, but a lot of the attention right now, too, is for housing coming out of the legislature.
Yeah, so the $448 million in HUD money, I gather that's money that the president had the authority without Congress to appropriate. But as you mentioned, there's this multi-billion dollar aid package that has been hung up in Congress. And Puerto Rico, and during his remarks in Panama City, the president cited this figure, which has been widely debunked, about Puerto Rico getting $91 billion in aid, and kind of, it's almost like he was kind of pitting Puerto Rico against Florida in this federal aid discussion. John Kennedy, do you get a sense, or did you get a sense from the Democrats, of whether this stalemate in Congress is going to be solved and the more money is going to flow to the panhandle?
Well, everybody seems to feel that, yes, they are getting closer to some kind of concession between Puerto Rico and the panhandle when it comes to what kind of money will be balanced out between the two areas. It sounds like the Republicans are willing to increase a little bit what is going to Puerto Rico, which they have been, in Trump world, it seems to be something that they feel that the administration in Puerto Rico has, wastefully spent this money, and it's been misdirected. So there's, no reason to keep pouring money into it. Plus, the Puerto Rico government has been pretty critical of Trump generally. The panhandle, by contrast, is a overwhelmingly Republican area, and it went especially big for Trump in 2016. And, if you believe electoral maps, there may be as few as five real toss-up states heading into the 2020 election. And Florida, of course, is the biggest one of all with 29 electoral votes. That's ahead of the other big state that looks like a toss-up right now would be Pennsylvania with 20 electoral votes. But Pennsylvania also looks like a state that could edge Democratic if, Scranton-born Joe Biden becomes the party's nominee. So there's no doubt that Trump needs Florida, and this visit was the first of many that he will be making to this state in the coming months.
Definitely. So I guess the political question here, and this is a politics podcast, at what point do you think frustrations, is there a possibility that the panhandle will, things will get bad enough that they will not come out, or that it'll hurt Trump's reelection prospects in 2020? What's your take on that?
That would be a reach, I think, for them to really abandon the Republican administration at this point. We've heard a little bit of a, you know, maybe a harbinger of what it's going to be like from the legislature, where there was very muted criticism of the kind of aid that was coming out of Washington to the panhandle. The criticism largely being, you know, that just Washington isn't working. It wasn't aimed at the administration, but it was more of a condemnation of, you know, House versus Senate. It and somehow the Democrats, in the eyes of Republicans, always, you know, emerge as the obstructionists. So there was not a lot of criticism from Tallahassee toward Trump, and I would not think that the panhandle would turn on him at any time soon either.
Right. You know, the one thing that sticks out to me, though, is in 2018, just after the hurricane hit, turnout in Bay County. Which Panama City is in Bay County, right?
Sure.
And in the 2018 election, statewide turnout was 62.6%, but in Bay County, which got walloped by that hurricane, turnout was only 52.9%. So almost 10 points lower turnout in that area, which is a very Republican area. So, I mean, that, you know, hurt Republicans by the depressed turnout. And so that's just something to watch. I mean, I don't suspect voters in the panhandle are going to suddenly become liberal Democrats. But, you know, if the turnout is depressed, that could also hurt Republicans in a close election. The other part, you know, a lot of this, Trump spoke for nearly an hour and a half, and a lot of it sounded like a 2016 rally. There were couple times I heard the build a wall chant and even a lock her up chant one time about Hillary Clinton. And one of the things Trump loved to do during his 2016 rallies during the Republican primary season was to tag his rivals with nicknames. Remember, there was low energy Jeb Bush and Lion Ted Cruz and Little Marco Rubio. In fact, one time when Trump was in Boca Raton, he even specified that Little Marco Rubio, you spelled it with a D. He even spelled it out, L-I-D-D-L-E, to, like, I guess, for maximum derision. So he really liked to attach the nicknames. And then, of course, in the general election, you know, Crooked Hillary Clinton. So now you've got more than 20 Democratic candidates running for president. It was interesting to see who he would mention in this rally in Florida. Here's a clip of the president mentioning a couple of the Democrats.
You got a choice between Sleepy Joe and Crazy Bernie. And I'll take any of them. Let's just pick somebody, please, and let's start this thing. Let's start it. Pick somebody. We have a young man, Boot Edge. They say Edge. He's got a great chance, doesn't he? He'll be great. Representing us against President Xi of China. That'll be great. I want to be in that room. I want to watch that one.
All right. So Sleepy Joe and Crazy Bernie, those are the two top Democrats in most polls. So that's not surprising. Kind of a boost there to Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bay, Indiana. That he would mention, that the president would mention him. So I don't know what to make of that. Later on, he also mentioned Beto O'Rourke. I think he mentioning that Beto's poll numbers have slipped, which tells you, A, that the president definitely does keep an eye on the polls. And I think Beto has always kind of annoyed Trump because he held that rally in Texas at the same time Trump was having a rally. And so the president likes to point out that he got more people at his. Any other takeaways you had from the president's appearance, John?
Well, I don't know. It just looks like something where you're going to see a lot more of Trump. And I think the focus on Florida is just going to keep, you know, increasing as the election takes hold. He's still freestyling on these hour and a half spiels, you know, that he can deliver. And you know, here he comes to an area that has really been devastated, and there's not a lot of, you know, he's far from the embracer in chief, you know, when it comes to an area like this. He just kind of comes in and does his thing. So, but the crowd that he can attract, it's that celebrity factor that, you know, is unmistakable with him. And the crowd there seemed to love him. So it's the beginning of a long adventure with Trump in Florida, I think, until next November.
You bet. Let's go back to 2019 for at least a little while. Since our last podcast, the legislative session has ended. So, John Kennedy, if we could cue up the Tallahassee theme music.
Get that swamp music coming in.
There it is. Sounds to me like CCR's Green River, but it's not. It's a royalty-free number called Swamp Rock that we use to discuss Tallahassee. So the legislative session is over, and so the big item is suspense. A is, you know, to see which bills Ron DeSantis will sign or veto, and then and we'll talk about Amendment 4 in particular, but then, you know, which things might prompt legal challenges. John Kennedy, give us a brief overview of where things stand from your perspective.
Well, we saw the governor has acted pretty quickly in signing into law one of the most opposed bills of the legislative session. That was the one that will allow teachers to become armed school guardians. It was opposed by the teachers union, the PTA, lots of gun opponents. But DeSantis signed it just hours after it was sent to him by the legislature. So he wasted no time on that. And as we record today's podcast, this is a Thursday, DeSantis is poised to sign another bill that will put about $136 million in taxpayer money right into private school vouchers. This is something called the Family Empowerment Scholarship. It's new, and it's going to be made available to 18,000 students from families that range into the middle income areas. On the budget, DeSantis has promised to trim back the $91.1 billion budget that was proposed by the legislature. It's been approved, but still awaiting the governor's signature. He didn't really sound, though, like he was going to swing the axe too freely, though, when it comes to vetoes. We have a little bit of sound here from the governor right after the legislature adjourned.
We have a $91.1 billion budget that was sent here. I think it's a pretty fair bet that it'll be under $91 billion when we're all said and done with it.
So that sounds kind of good, but you know, when you think about it, it's like, well, okay, maybe a little more than $100 million in spending vetoes. That is not exactly like off the charts when it comes to vetoes. On policy, though, he also he found a lot of stuff, Republican stuff, to like. But included were some controversial bills, the ban on sanctuary cities that prohibits something that's not really happening in Florida, but it definitely helps the party's base, which really wants to see steps aimed at cracking down on immigration. DeSantis is going to sign this one, too, while avoiding any acknowledgement that it probably will do little other than cause more anxiety in some already pretty marginalized immigrant communities. And it'll probably also spark some racial profiling when it comes to interactions between law enforcement and immigrants. Groups like the League of Women Voters, the ACLU, and others, they'd urge DeSantis to veto all these bills. And they also want him to veto legislation that's pushed by Senate President Bill Galvano and the road building industry, which would carve three big new toll roads across the state. The opponents say it's going to cause environmental problems and encourage more sprawl. Now, DeSantis, for what it's worth, he's been a little more guarded when asked about this legislation, saying that he needs to learn more about it. But right now, if I was a betting man, and okay, I know a gambling compact was not among the bills that was approved this year, but I'd say that DeSantis might veto this highway bill just because, you know, I mean, it's always tough to stick it to the Republican Senate president. But I wonder if it folds into his view of, you know, where the environment should be heading in Florida right now. There's other...
veto on the Galvano highway bill. Did I hear that?
I think that could happen. I think that could be a surprise out of this this new governor. But
bold.
You know, it's bold. It's bold
prediction.
Of course, now there's other eye-catching legislation, and we can talk about more too. And that's and it's before DeSantis. It's awaiting action. It's going to be his effort to try to enact last year's voter-approved Amendment 4 that allowed former felons to register as voters. And there's another one that puts barriers in front of future citizens' ballot initiatives. But that Amendment 4 initiative, is an interesting one, and it's going to divide the Democrats and Republicans going forward and probably head to the courts pretty soon.
So, right. And just to we've discussed it a few times before on the podcast, voters approved this measure to restore voting rights to felons who have completed their sentences. I think the language on the ballot might have said completed all the terms of their sentences or something like that. And so the legislature enacted a law that said in order to complete the terms of your sentence, that includes paying fines that might have been imposed by a judge as part of the sentence. And so that's what the big argument is. And you've had Democrats saying that amounts to a poll tax and invoking Jim Crow accusations. Regardless of what you think of the issue, I mean, now that the thing has passed and I'm assuming the governor's going to sign it, the legal question, I don't see how the one of the things that came out in this debate is that when this issue was before the Florida Supreme Court for review, as all ballot questions are, one of the attorneys for the Amendment 4 supporters told the Supreme Court, I think it was in 2017, that paying fines and restitution was part of completing a sentence. And that was John Mills, who used to be a speaker of the House in Florida back when Democrats were in control in the 80s or 90s. As a legal matter, John Kennedy, I would expect that would be key. And do you see any way around that? I mean, how could a court overturn what the legislature did when their own attorney was saying fines were part of it?
Well, I think one area that strikes me is that the bill does include provisions which allow a court to waive outstanding costs or to convert restitution to community service and abolish the restitution with the permission from the victim of the ex-felon's crime. I think some of these provisions may end up, possibly costing this legislation, because if a lawsuit is filed and if this goes to federal court, the differences in how felons may get their voting rights restored will vary to some degree from judicial circuit to judicial circuit. And I think that seems to be something that might violate the Constitution's equal protection requirements under the law. You know, so all told, we may get to revisit Bush v. Gore, which you remember stopped a recount in Florida back in 2000 because of equal protection problems with Florida using different criteria to measure voter intent in different counties when they were examining hanging chads and dimple chads. So we all remember that too well. But I think some of those same, varying applications of this new law could be something that a federal court might look askance at. So we'll have to see.
In other words, if a judge in one circuit allows a person to waive the fines and another one doesn't, they're not voters in the same state, not being treated equally. Okay, interesting possibility there. Definitely something to keep an eye on. Another thing that passed that we talked about on the podcast, you remember back at the beginning of the session, human trafficking. There were several human trafficking bills in this session, and they were kind of got some momentum in February when New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft was arrested here in Palm Beach County, and he and 24 other men were charged with soliciting prostitution at a massage parlor in Jupiter. And initially, authorities were saying that the massage parlor was connected to human trafficking. And as it turns out, no, it doesn't appear that they're going to bring any charges related to human trafficking in these cases of Kraft or these other men. But But the issue of human trafficking was highlighted, and the legislature did pass some legislation that, among other things, a person usually it's men, but a person arrested for soliciting prostitution, which is a misdemeanor offense, if they are convicted or plead no contest, their names will go on a registry of people that have been convicted of that, and with the idea that that would be a deterrent to people buying prostitutes, and that would then reduce the demand for these women that are trafficked. That's one of the aspects of the legislation. It also requires a lot more training for people that work in massage parlors and doctor's offices and also law enforcement, just to recognize signs of human trafficking. That was a bill that the legislature passed. The governor has not announced what he plans to do about it, but I suspect that he will sign it. What else, John Kennedy, what else should we be looking at in terms of going forward, outstanding legislation?
Well, another thing that caught a lot of attention really in the closing hours of the session that DeSantis is almost guaranteed to sign is changes to citizens' initiatives, to how efforts to try to get ballot items before voters. Legislation passed that prohibits per signature paying people that are going around trying to collect signatures to get an amendment on the ballot. This is an industry, but it's something that is used by many higher profile citizens campaigns. And in this coming year, already underway, there's some that could raise the minimum wage, ban assault weapons, deregulate the utility industry. These are all things that alienate organizations close to the Republican Party. John Morgan, the Orlando lawyer who is at the center of trying to get successfully getting medical marijuana approved by voters a couple of years ago, he's leading the effort to increase the state's minimum wage next year. And after the legislature acted to prohibit these per signature payments, he said on Twitter, he said, "These jokers are so owned by special interests that they actually thumb their nose at democracy." So Morgan, there's probably some way around this for campaigns that are trying to collect signatures, because you have to come in with about 766,000 valid signatures from registered voters to get an amendment on the ballot. But this per payment plan is something that is a pretty conventional way for organizations to get people to go out and stand on corners and ask people to sign a petition. But whether forcing these organizations to just pay these people by the hour, is that going to completely disrupt this effort or not? But it just seems like it's one more hurdle that the legislature doesn't like to be told what to do by voters, and that seems to be something that is pretty standard. You remember, it was not too long ago, 2006, that they raised the bar to a 60% approval was needed to get a constitutional amendment approved, and that's right. The highest in the nation right now. So that's another one that again, I think the governor is going to sign, but it's drawing a lot of criticism from a lot of quarters.
Mark Wilson, the head of the Florida Chamber of Commerce, I heard him recently given a rundown of the just completed legislative session, and he mentioned that legislation as one of the as a success, something that business was very pleased with, the business community, this limiting these petition gatherers. So there you go. I suspect the governor will sign that one as well, but it will be interesting to see if these, if John Morgan and these other people are find some way to work around if it really does disrupt the petition gathering process. Well, I think I'm hearing that funky royalty-free music again. So it's time to return to our pick a number segment. Only two numbers this week. John Kennedy with the number 11. What was that?
I'll go low. We talked about this before the session started, but only 11% of the general and local bills filed by legislators actually passed this spring. That's 194 bills out of 1,729 filed. And oddly enough, that percentage is exactly the same as it was last year. Very close to the same number of bills approved and filed. So we have kind of a Groundhog Day for those of us who covered both sessions and more. What's an unknown now, of course, is how the governor is going to treat the menu of bills that are before him compared to last year's Governor Scott. Scott, last year, he signed 193 bills into law and vetoed only two. So, you know, we'll see where DeSantis goes. He's talking about vetoing more policy bills, along with axing that more than $100 million in the budget that we spoke about earlier. So, but the numbers sure shape up very similar between 2018 and 19.
And we have that bold John Kennedy prediction that the governor might veto that massive highway bill. So if that happens, you'll look like quite the soothsayer. My number was 500. 500 is the approximate number of pages of documents that a WikiLeaks attorney named Jason Fishbein from Palm Beach Gardens, Florida, turned over to Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigators last year. I wrote a story about Mr. Fishbein in the Palm Beach Post recently just because he's from Florida. And it was interesting because he's mentioned only once in the unredacted version of the Mueller report, which is 448 pages. In September 2016, he got a password to preview an anti-Trump website. A preview, you know, you could read it, but not make any changes to it. He got this password, so he sent it to WikiLeaks. He thought it might be of interest to WikiLeaks. And WikiLeaks, in turn, gave that password to Donald Trump Jr. And the Mueller report highlighted that just as an example of direct communications between WikiLeaks and the Trump campaign. So Mr. Fishbein, I brought up the number just because Mr. Fishbein played a minor role. As I said, he's only mentioned once, but it does offer a glimpse of the Mueller team, how they went about their job. You know, this guy that's mentioned once in the Mueller report turned over 500 pages of documents and estimates he interviewed with them for 5 or 6 hours and, you know, had to hire an attorney. And I don't know what that cost. So just a little glimpse of the thoroughness of the Mueller team as evidenced by their interaction with one Florida man. Well, that wraps up another one of our Inside Florida Politics podcasts. I am Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett. Always my honor to be your host. I've been assisted here in West Palm Beach by Corzano. That's the team of Thomas Porty and Joe Forzano. And I've been joined from Tallahassee by Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief John Kennedy. Zach Anderson of the Sarasota Herald Tribune was not with us this week, but he should be back next week. And also, as always, assisting us from New Hampshire, the Gatehouse Digital Audio Production Director, Adam Fish. Thank you.